The following podcast is produced following the workshop, Chinese Objects Outside of China, which took place at Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library from June 5th to June 9th, 2017. The workshop is part of the Chinese Object Study Workshops program, administered by the Freer Gallery of Art and the Arthur M. Sackler Gallery, the Smithsonian's Museums of Asian Art, and sponsored by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. In the homogenized world of commodities, an eventful biography of a thing becomes the story of the various singularizations of it, of classifications and reclassifications in an uncertain world of categories whose importance shifts with every minor change in context. As with persons, the drama here lies in the uncertainties of valuation and of identity. These are the words of Igor Kopytov, who advocated in his 1986 essay titled The Cultural Biography of Things, for people to think about objects more like we typically think of each other, that is, to recognize that objects have biographies, that in a sense they have lives, and that they change identity as they move through different geographical regions, periods of time, and cultural and social contexts. Just like when meeting a new person, when we encounter a historical object, there are a lot of questions that we might want to ask of it, like, what is its identity? Where did it come from and who made it? How and when was it made and for what purpose? Who owned it and what did it mean to that person? Why did it change hands? Rarely, however, are there simple answers to these questions, as objects may have a multitude of identities in relation to different things, people, places, and historical moments. Museum professionals face a difficult task when it comes to labeling objects in their collections, because this requires distilling the biographies of things into a couple lines of text. The idea of objects having multiple, changeable, or uncertain identities can also be difficult to navigate, especially when concepts like authenticity and cultural practices such as collecting enter the mix. Here I will explore the unstable identity of one object in the Winterthur collection over the course of its lifetime. After all, it's in these uncertainties where the drama can be found. The object of focus is a porcelain dish with a glossy yellow enamel surface covered in intricately twisting vines, clumps of wisteria blossoms, roses, and a magpie, all painted in shades of gray. Also on its face are the red Chinese characters Daya Jai, or Hall of Great Elegance, and a red oval seal that reads Tian Di Yi Jia Chun, or Spring United in Heaven and Earth, in seal script framed in a circle of red dragons. If you flip the plate over, in the very center of the base is a red square seal that reads Yongqing Chang Chun, or Forever Celebration of the Eternal Spring, and around the underside of the plate's lip are four red bats, which in Chinese serve as a pun for great happiness. Winterthur also has in its collection another matching plate and two bowls of the same design. Based on its high chroma yellow enamel surface, punctuated with a grisaille pattern of flowers and birds, as well as its three distinctive markings, the plate appears to be part of a large set of porcelain dinner services commissioned by the Empress Dowager Cixi in the late 19th century, towards the end of the Qing Dynasty. Pieces from this group of porcelains are commonly referred to as Daya Jai wares because of the three-character inscription that they bear. If you could pick the plate up and hold it now, you would also note that it is fairly light for its size and that the clay is potted quite thinly, further indications of high-quality porcelain made for the imperial household. Identifying the dish as Daya Jai ware gives us a great deal of information about its biography, including who commissioned it, the process of its design, when and where it was fired, and its intended use. But first, let's talk briefly about Cixi, the extraordinary woman who commissioned the Daya Jai wares. Cixi, whose formal title reads Empress Dowager Cixi of the Great Qing Empire, maintained almost uninterrupted political control of China for about 50 years, from 1861 to 1908. Her name changed multiple times over the course of her lifetime as her position in court changed. But for simplicity's sake, I will refer to her throughout as Cixi, or as the Empress Dowager. She was first selected as the Xianfeng Emperor's fifth-rank imperial consort in 1852 and gave birth to his only male heir, the future Tongzhi Emperor. When the Xianfeng Emperor died in 1861, his son was still a small child. Upon his death, the Xianfeng Emperor's empress received the title of Empress Dowager Cian, and Cixi promoted herself to Junior Empress Dowager in the name of her son, the new Tongzhi Emperor. Cixi and Cian wielded significant political power as regents because the deceased Xianfeng Emperor left Cian and his son each a seal, which were to be stamped at the beginning and end of every imperial order. Because the Tongzhi Emperor was still so young, Cixi was entrusted with his seal. After coming of age, he assumed the duties of emperor, but the Tongzhi Emperor died only 2 years into his personal rule. Cixi then appointed his successor, her four-year-old nephew, as the Guangxu Emperor, and the two empress dowagers once again became regents. Empress Dowager Cian died in 1881, making Cixi the sole regent until 1889, when the Guangxu Emperor began his direct rule. However, his controversial Hundred Days reform a decade later ended with Cixi effectively terminating his rule and again acting as regent until both of their deaths in 1908. In addition to wielding significant political control, Cixi also broke down gender barriers in the arts by taking charge of porcelain commissions and the budget for the imperial kiln. The commissioning of porcelain was a right and a responsibility typically reserved for the emperor, but since Cixi acted on behalf of the young emperors Tongzhi and Guangxu, she not only took control of porcelain commissions, but also reorganized the imperial workshops responsible for production to suit her needs. The making of porcelain designs had been under the purview of the painting workshop, but when Cixi commissioned porcelain dinner services to commemorate the wedding of her son, she sent design orders to the embroidery workshop. Cixi made the embroidery workshop responsible for the design of both attire and of porcelain. Even after she handed power to the Tongzhi Emperor, she continued to oversee porcelain commissions for the imperial household, and it is during this period that she ordered the Daya Jai wares from the imperial kiln at Jingdezhen in Jiangxi province. As a Daya Jai porcelain, our plate's biography begins in the mind of Cixi, who issued orders to the embroidery workshop for the designs of the dinner services in 1874. The artisans in the embroidery workshop then drew up designs, showing the different combinations of porcelain shapes, enamel colors, and patterns of birds and flowers. Every illustration had to meet Cixi's approval before they were sent along with written instructions to the imperial kiln in Jingdezhen. The floral patterns on some of the Daya Jai wares bear resemblance to those on garments worn by Cixi. It has been suggested that Cixi's reason for placing porcelain design into the hands of the embroidery workshop may have been that her frequent orders of customized attire led to her familiarity and comfort with the artisans there. In any case, there are clear visual correspondences between the motifs and colors of porcelain commissioned by Cixi to those seen in her robes. Before Cixi's time, it was uncommon for wisteria to appear on clothing or porcelain, but this was a motif that the Empress Dowager favored, as can be seen in a 1903 oil portrait by Catherine Carl of Cixi in wisteria-covered robes, and in three of the design drawings of the Daya Jai wares. On May 15, 1874, the embroidery workshop sent instructions and 31 design drawings to the imperial kiln. The Qing regime set up their imperial kiln in Jingdezhen in 1655. 200 years later, the Taiping Rebellion brought devastating destruction to the kilns, prompting Cixi to order their reconstruction in 1865. It is this reconstructed kiln site that received the designs and instructions for the Daya Jai wares, a commission totaling 4,922 pieces, in August of 1874. By that time, the imperial kiln was already at the end of its annual work cycle, and the order could not be filled until the following year. Therefore, while the Daya Jai wares were commissioned in 1874, the last year of the reign of the Tongzhi Emperor, they were fired between 1875 and 1876, the first and second years of the reign of the Guangxu Emperor. In commissioning the Daya Jai wares, Cixi was following the example of past Qing dynasty rulers, who specially commissioned porcelain for their residences. Her original intention was to use the Daya Zhai wares at her residence in the Yuanmingyuan, the Gardens of Perfect Brightness, a complex of gardens and palace buildings a few kilometers northwest of the Forbidden City in Beijing. The Yuanmingyuan was the seat of the Qing government in the 18th and 19th centuries, but after a combination of British and French troops looted and burned it in 1860 during the Second Opium War, the court relocated to the Forbidden City. The Tongzhi Emperor set out to have the complex rebuilt as a place of retirement for Cixi and Ze'an in 1873, and Cixi ordered the Daya Zhai wares in anticipation of using them in the Yuanmingyuan. However, the Tongzhi Emperor soon terminated the reconstruction project at the urging of high officials, who cited a lack of financial resources, and the completed sets of Daya Zhai wares ended up instead in the imperial palace in the Forbidden City. The three distinctive inscriptions on the Daya Zhai wares reference their intended home in the Yuanmingyuan. Throughout much of her life, Cixi identified herself with Daya Zhai, or Hall of Great Elegance, characters that she received written on a tablet from the Xianfeng Emperor while she was his concubine Virtue. Cixi later called her studio Daya Zhai and used the name as a seal to mark her paintings and calligraphies. Tian Di Yi Jia Chun, or Spring United in Heaven and Earth, the oval seal surrounded by dragons, was the title of Cixi's residence within the Yuanmingyuan complex. The four characters on the base of the Winterthur plate refer to the Gardens of Eternal Spring, the Changchunyuan, also within the Yuanmingyuan complex. The Daya Zhai wares connect in multiple ways to the identity of Cixi. The bird and flower motifs relate to the designs used in the Empress Dowager's wardrobe. Daya Zhai was her personal mark, and the seals reference her residence in the Yuanmingyuan. Furthermore, these objects are material representations of Cixi's art patronage and control of the imperial kiln, and thus also of her extensive political power. In addition to tying into Cixi's personal style and identity, the Daya Zhai wares also connect the Empress Dowager to a lineage of Qing Dynasty rulers. Brightly enameled porcelain featuring botanical patterns appeared in the late 17th century during the reign of the Kangxi Emperor. Wisteria also has a longer history in imperial art patronage and is especially associated with the Qianlong Emperor, who commissioned painted scenic illusions of wisteria for the ceiling of the Palace of Tranquil Longevity, his retirement studio in the Forbidden City, in 1774. The yellow plate with wisteria in Winterthur's collection can therefore be seen as intimately tied to the identity of a specific person, the Empress Dowager Cixi, as well as to the Qing Dynasty imperial lineage and tradition of porcelain patronage. The majority of extant Daya Zhai wares are held in the Palace Museum in Beijing, as they were possessions of the imperial household and therefore not objects that could be freely bought and sold. However, a number of porcelain pieces resembling Daya Zhai wares can be found today in collections in the West. Towards the end of the Qing Dynasty, many important artworks were taken out of the Forbidden City and the Yuanmingyuan as a result of foreign incursions and domestic rebellions. An article by Captain J.H. Lawrence Archer, published in 1875, describes his experience hunting for imperial porcelain in Beijing soon after the 1860 looting and destruction of the Yuanmingyuan. He writes that he was fortunate, quote, to arrive in China when so many splendid or beautiful specimens, hoarded jealously for centuries in the imperial depositories, at length became known to the outer and at that period scarcely appreciative world. He continues, quote, the finer kinds of porcelain rose and fell in price according to the rumors of the maintenance or the withdrawal of the European force, or, in the latter event, the possession by a native of his sovereign's property would, to say the least, have been inconvenient. Captain Lawrence Archer's account alludes to the risk that a Chinese merchant trading in stolen imperial goods would face. However, it was apparently not uncommon for palace eunuchs and officials at the end of the dynasty to smuggle and sell objects from the imperial palace. While the Daya Jai wares could not have been taken from the imperial collection during the looting of the Yuanming Yuan, as they were not fired until the 1870s, it's possible that pieces were looted by members of the Eight-Nation Alliance during the extensive plunder of Beijing and surrounding areas that occurred in 1900 during the Boxer Rebellion, when foreign troops occupied Beijing and the Qing court evacuated to Xi'an. At this time, many looted objects were laundered through the art market, and their provenance and method of acquisition obscured and then forgotten. Was this sunny yellow plate one of those taken objects, slipped out of the imperial palace by a profit-seeking court eunuch, or grabbed in the looting frenzy of the Boxer Rebellion? There is still another possibility I'd like to explore, which is that this plate may have never entered the imperial palace to begin with. Its biography, then, would sound very different. As I mentioned before, the embroidery workshop sent instructions and illustrations of the Daya Jai wares to the imperial kiln in 1874. Those documents are now in the library of the Palace Museum in Beijing. After reading the descriptions of each combination of shape, color, and pattern for the Daya Jai wares set out in the instructions, it appears that none match the combination seen in the Winterthur plate. The plate looks so similar to other Daya Jai porcelains and seems to fit with the others because it combines elements from two of the original Daya Jai designs. The instructions describe a set of porcelain pieces with a pattern of grisaille hibiscus flowers against a yellow ground, and also a set with a multicolored wisteria motif against a turquoise ground. The makers of the Winterthur plate appear to have combined the wisteria motif of the latter with the grisaille and yellow color palette of the former to create a new design that still feels very much like Daya Jai ware. However, in addition to not fitting into the 1874 instructions, the Winterthur plate also displays a few other discrepancies from Daya Jai wares seen in the palace museums in Beijing and Taipei. The rim of the Winterthur plate is white where the yellow enamel peters out towards the edge. In this way, it stands apart from the Daya Jai dishes in the palace museums that virtually all have either a gilt rim or a patterned rim in a contrasting color. The preponderance of gilt or patterned rims can also be seen in non-Daya Jai porcelains from the Tongzhi and Guangxu reigns. The lack of any visual remnants of gilt on the rim of the Winterthur plate doesn't fit in with other imperial wares from the period. The grisaille botanical motif on the Winterthur plate is also visually different from the grisaille motifs on Daya Jai wares in the palace museums. Overall, the patterning on the Winterthur plate is rendered in darker shades of gray, while other Daya Jai porcelains display motifs in a much lighter range of grays with more variation in shade. Lastly, four red bats dot the underside of the lip of the Winterthur plate, while none of the Daya Jai wares in the palace museums display bats, although a number of porcelain dishes commissioned by Cixi to commemorate the Tongzhi Emperor's wedding have a motif of red bats on a yellow ground. The Winterthur plate, therefore, does not seem to be a Daya Jai ware, though it is possible that Cixi commissioned it at another time. The Empress Dowager is known to have commissioned tens of thousands of pieces of porcelain from the imperial kiln in honor of her 50th, 60th, and 70th birthdays in 1884, 1894, and 1904. Among these commissions are several groups of porcelain inscribed with the titles of various architectural sites. The production of these groupings of porcelain seem to correlate with the timing of Cixi's renovation projects of the different palace buildings. She ordered the renovation of the Palace of Concentrated Beauty, the Chuxiugong, to celebrate her 50th birthday in 1884, and it seems likely that she commissioned the set of porcelain with corresponding inscriptions to accompany this project. The Hall of Embodied Harmony, the Tihe Dian, was renovated in the same year to serve as her dining hall, and so it seems likely that she ordered the set of porcelain with the corresponding inscriptions at the same time. Cixi initiated renovation of the Hall of Pleasant Longevity, the Le Shou Tang, 10 years later to celebrate her 60th birthday, and probably ordered the porcelains with the corresponding inscriptions for this setting. The Daya Jai wares also show Cixi's tendency to coordinate architectural renovations with porcelain commissions. However, The renovation project that accompanied the Dayazhai Commission was aborted, and so it seems unlikely that Cixi would later order additional dishes with the same inscriptions as the Dayazhai wares. The Winchester plate displays a skillful combination of two of the approved Dayazhai designs, as well as the three inscriptions associated with Dayazhai wares, suggesting that its makers had knowledge of the imperial porcelain and access to their design illustrations. It is possible that this plate was not produced in the imperial kiln, but rather in one of Qing De Zhen's many commercial kilns. In the late Qing Dynasty and early Republic, it was fairly common for information to exchange hands between workers in the imperial kiln and those in commercial kilns to facilitate technical improvements and the production of imitation wares. The design illustrations for the Dayazhai Commission may have entered into a pattern book at the imperial kiln that could then be used as a reference to create new combinations of patterns and colors in the same style later on. This could explain why there are a number of different variations on the yellow enamel with grisaille wisteria design in art collections in the West that don't seem to fit together into a single dinner service. The existence of a market in late Qing Dynasty Beijing for forged imperial wares can be glimpsed in the account of Captain Lawrence Archer, who wrote in 1875 that a certain British high official he knew was one day lounging on a sofa when a Chinese dealer, carrying something carefully wrapped up in cloth under his arm, suddenly rushed into the room, trembling and evidently in great alarm. The cause of the intrusion was rapidly explained. He had become possessed of a specimen of imperial porcelain, which jeopardized his head, and he was anxious to dispose of it. The generous purchaser did not hesitate to pay $200 for the treasure of art. A few days later, the official, with an air of mystery, told a visitor that he would show him something of matchless value, and produced the vase. "I have seen that before," said the latter. "Impossible," said the official. "I am certain. It was offered to me by the vendor a few days ago." "Then the price was perhaps too high?" asked the official. "Not at all. The fellow only wanted $3 for it." In a similar vein, George Lynch, a reporter in Beijing during the Boxer Rebellion in 1900, observed that when offered a china cup or saucer, the correct thing to do was to look at the mark at the bottom as if one understood what it meant. Both of these anecdotes indicate that the demand for looted porcelain amongst Europeans was high, but buyers did not always have the required knowledge to judge the wares on offer. The market for stolen imperial goods thus opened up opportunities for savvy merchants to make a profit selling forged imperial porcelain. This practice may have continued after the end of the Qing Dynasty and on into the Republican period. The Winchester plate may or may not have been produced in the imperial kiln for the Empress Dowager Cixi, which would place it in the category of imperial porcelain. It also may or may not have been produced in a commercial kiln with the intention of being sold to a foreign buyer, which would place it in the category of export porcelain. Materially speaking, an enameled porcelain plate made in Qing De Zhen for the imperial household and one made there to be sold for export might not be very different. Using the same or very similar materials and techniques, the physical objects could be practically indistinguishable. Yet the way in which scholars, collectors, and connoisseurs have traditionally approached imperial porcelains as authentically Chinese, singularized art objects differs drastically from the traditional view of export porcelain as commodities in the context of global trade. What, however, is the usefulness of upholding these modes of classification? The Winchester plate demonstrates how a single object can straddle this dividing line and complicate the established dichotomies between Chinese porcelain and export porcelain, and between art objects and commodities. Its identity is far from clear-cut, but this uncertainty amplifies, rather than diminishes, the historical interest of Winchester's wisteria plate.